To CGSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Coast Salish peoples.
Welcome to Electronic Intifada Radio. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. On this episode, Israel can't stop killing. Ali Abunima discusses the plans to occupy Gaza with a foreign force working on behalf of Israel.
That is where official thinking is, that the question of Palestine is merely one of finding the right caliber bullets to kill the right Palestinians and to find the right collaborators to rule the survivors on behalf of the colonial occupier. These people just are incapable of conceiving that the Palestinians are a people with rights, dignity, and determination to win their liberation.
And on the resistance report, John Elmer covers Palestinian fighters who, according to the so-called ceasefire agreement, were supposed to have amnesty to leave the eastern side of the yellow line in Rafah.
After a month of being attacked in ceasefire violations, fighters attacked the Israeli force that had come to the building that they were hiding out in. Five of their soldiers were wounded, one seriously by Yassin 105 fire and a guerrilla action device that was affixed to the Namur troop carrier.
This is Electronic Intifada Radio. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. This episode highlights the news, interviews, and reports from our live stream broadcast on December 4th, 2025. Later in the show, Ali Abunima reports on the latest in the Trump administration's plan to occupy Gaza with a foreign force working on behalf of Israel, a plan that appears to be falling apart before it even gets off the ground. On the resistance report, John Elmer examines the situation of the Palestinian fighters who remain on the eastern side of the yellow line. But first, we've published many features on the Electronic Intifada in the last week, but we wanted to bring you excerpts from piece we didn't publish ourselves but wanted very much to amplify, since it is authored by our longtime contributor Yusuf El-Jamal, who is based in Turkey. In his new piece for Middle East Eye titled Overnight, an Israeli Strike Turned My Family's Home in Gaza into a Graveyard, Yusuf writes about waking up to the news that a missile hit his parents' house and killed 9 family members awaiting evacuation, as he says, leaving me with a guilt so deep it feels as if they survived and I did not. Yusuf writes, on September 27th, I woke up at 5:10 a.m. in my apartment in Turkey, feeling suffocated and thirsty. I was uneasy for no clear reason. I reached for my phone to read the latest updates from Gaza. I saw a message in my town's news sharing group in Gaza that an Israeli airstrike had targeted my family's home. I texted my brother, Aboud, but the message did not go through. Moments later, my mother, who now lives near me in Turkey, called. Her voice trembled with fear as she asked whether I had read the news. I walked straight out of my apartment and down the road to her house. My heart froze and my chest felt heavy. I refused to believe that my worst nightmare during the Gaza genocide had become real, but the feeling of suffocation would not go away. On the way, I called a friend in Gaza. Together, we managed to reach my sister, Sara. That small victory gave me hope that my family had survived. But soon after, Sara told me that Aboud, his wife, also named Sara, and their 2 daughters, Huda and Zainab, had been killed. The airstrike had also killed my sister Ghalia, her husband Yusuf, and their daughters, Mariam and Zainab, as well as my brother-in-law, Dr. Khalid. My sister Mariam and 2 of her 5 children were injured. I have experienced immense loss during the Gaza genocide, but it is different when an airstrike hits your own home. Something deeper is taken when the place that helped shape you is destroyed. The missile destroyed not only the walls, doors, and floors I grew up with. It felt as though it shattered the memories that lived inside them, too, ones I shared with my beloved family members in that space. A wave of grief washed over me, leaving a hollow ache in my chest. I also felt helpless and guilty. The night before the airstrike in our home, My sister had sent me a list of 24 family members she hoped I could help evacuate. It included my surviving siblings, nephews, and nieces. They were excited at the idea of being saved from the genocide, of living without fear or destruction, of putting their children to sleep without wondering whether they would survive the night. All of that hope vanished in a single moment. Our lives changed forever. Our home was known for being full of siblings and grandchildren. Not anymore. Since the attack, my surviving family members have been busy repairing whatever they can in our home so they are able to return. It's better than living in a tent, they say. But now they must live in a house that has become the graveyard of my siblings, their spouses, and their children. I do not even want to imagine what that means for them. In Gaza, people are constantly forced to choose between two bad options. Since the start of the genocide, I have lost 16 immediate family members. Most days, it feels as though those who were killed are the real survivors, while the rest of us who remain carry an unending, overwhelming pain. My guilt for not saving my loved ones increases by the day, and I tell myself that the Palestinians of Gaza, as a community, as so-called survivors, will never be the same. The tightness in my chest also grows with each passing day. The whole genocide feels unreal. To dull the pain and to try to escape from this reality, I imagine that I never lived in Gaza, and that the Gaza that formed me, the Gaza that is gone, never existed. In that world, I imagine my family living in a place where we celebrate their lives rather than their memories. In that world, my nephews would grow up in peace, and their heads and arms would not have to be collected from meters away. In that world, Dr. Khaled would have completed another master's degree in pediatrics. Aboud would have sung for our family and left Gaza, as he always wished. Huda and Zozo would have met my newborn. Mariam and Zainab would have tried on new clothes instead of being buried and burned in them. In that world, there is no genocide, and no political leader doubts Palestinians' right to life. Maybe someday we will build that world together. Those are excerpts from Overnight, an Israeli Strike Turned My Family's Home in Gaza into a Graveyard by Yusuf El-Jamal, writing from Turkey on Middle East Eye. Yusuf is the Gaza coordinator at the Palestine Activism Program at the American Friends Service Committee. He holds a doctorate in Middle Eastern Studies. He's a Palestinian refugee from Gaza and a senior non-resident scholar at the Hashim Sani Center for Palestine Studies at the University of Malaya in Malaysia. He has contributed to a number of books on Palestine, including Gaza Rights Back and Light in Gaza, and is our dear contributor and longtime friend here at the Electronic Intifada. We mourn for and with Yusuf and his family. Still to come on Electronic Intifada Radio, Ali Abunima tells us about an Israel-backed Gaza militia leader that was killed as the Trump plan fails. But before we get to that, the Electronic Intifada's John Elmer reports on the Palestinian fighters who remain on the eastern side of the yellow line.
This is the resistance report for day 790 of Israel's genocidal war in Gaza, and it is day 56 of the ceasefire, such as it is. We're now in the 3rd December of this war. I say as such with the ceasefire, of course, because ceasefire is in name only. The IDF has been bragging about the number of airstrikes. The other day, they bragged about 250 airstrikes in less than 3 weeks in the Gaza Strip. And that is just in that period of time. So there's been hundreds more as well. The Gaza Media Office and the United Nations Relief Works Agency, UNRWA, their numbers for the ceasefire, which began October 11th, are 356 Palestinians killed, 909 wounded. That number goes up by the hour in more than 600 military violations of the ceasefire that happened daily. These ceasefire violations that are counted do not include the failure to fulfill the humanitarian terms that were agreed upon, including key components of it like fuel, which only a fraction of has gotten in, fuel is, of course, the key to Palestinian sovereignty inside Gaza, to be able to do reconstruction on their own, to be able to fix their own society and not wait for the U.S.'s Board of Peace or whatever to find people to participate in the rebuilding. The Palestinians will rebuild on their own. And that's why the fuel is being held back as part of Israel's genocidal campaign. Also, we know it's the winter. We see the footage coming out of Gaza of the rain. Shelter units that were promised, that were agreed upon, have not been delivered. And all kinds of machinery. We know the heavy machinery to find people that are buried in the rubble. There has been some of that machinery brought into Gaza, but it's been brought in to find Israelis, not Palestinians. And of course, spare parts, you'll hear constantly coming out of Gaza, the shortage of spare parts that Israel has prevented from getting in. None of those last things that I've said count as ceasefire violations in the 600 tally that's being used. The 600 violations are military martial violations. Yeah. And like I said, more than 350 killed and nearly 1,000 wounded. Gaza is 80% refugees, descendants from the Nakba in 1948 and the 3 years after, where Palestinians were warehoused and then ultimately put into the Gaza Strip, where the Gaza Strip became the warehouse. Originally, the border of the Gaza Strip were the settlements, and that is the Gaza envelope. Israel used militarized civilian settlements as the border. After the first intifada, the Israelis began to fence off Gaza. The boundary was fenced off beginning in the first intifada in the late 1980s, and that culminates in the second intifada. By the second intifada, the wall around Gaza is concrete wall, high concrete walls. And then once the settlers were driven out of Gaza, along with the soldiers, Israel began to set about its high-tech iron wall that was so spectacularly breached and dismantled on October the 7th. It was a wall that was supposed to block underground tunnels. It was supposed to be the most high-tech border fence in the world, and the Qassam Brigades dismantled that in minutes. Rafah is what we are going to focus on today, because I want to talk about the fighters that are trapped on the other side of that yellow line. In Rafah, it's a massive area in southern Gaza, in Khan Yunis and Rafah area, that falls on the eastern side of the line, and the fighters have remained there. The original Trump administration plan granted amnesty to the Qassam fighters, to all fighters who are on that side of the line, and that was part of the agreement that was negotiated and agreed upon by the resistance, the understanding that that would happen. In early November, Washington, at this point, Washington is vernacular to replace Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff, who are basically in charge of this entire process themselves, and based it mostly, as they bragged about on a long 60 Minutes interview, that the entire ceasefire was essentially organized through cell phone calls to key leaders in the region that would back this plan. But the plan from early November from Washington was to find a quick solution to the standoff between the Hamas fighters on the eastern side of the line in Rafah. Kushner and Witkoff even made an express visit to Israel in November in order to tell Israel to allow the fighters to cross. We'll remember that gestures of good faith between Kushner, Witkoff, and the Palestinian resistance had been much. The resistance handed over for nothing one of the American Israeli soldiers that was held captive as a measure of good faith that was supposed to start the negotiation. So they're already, Kushner and Witkoff, in debt to the resistance. So they actually flew over to Israel with the express purpose of meeting with Netanyahu to sort this situation out. Witkoff spoke in November at a business conference in Miami, where he talked about 200 fighters trapped in Rafah. He started talking about surrender only in November, and that shows how little he understands about the conflict that he is the lead negotiator on. Qassam was not going to surrender. They were negotiated for safe passage back to Palestinian-controlled area in the Gaza Strip. Hamas put out a statement to that saying the brutal crime the occupation is committing by pursuing, killing, and arresting the fighters trapped in the tunnels of Rafah is a blatant violation of the ceasefire agreement and clear proof of the ongoing attempts to undermine and destroy this agreement. Hamas presented specific mechanisms to address the matter while maintaining full communication with the mediators and with the American administration as the key guarantor of the ceasefire. We hold the occupation fully responsible for the lives of our fighters, and we call on the mediators to intervene urgently and pressure the occupation to allow our men to return to their homes. They represent a unique example of sacrifice, heroism, and patience, and they are a symbol of the dignity and freedom of the Palestinian people. And we have seen recently, over the past month, the ICRC traveling on the eastern side of the yellow line with Qassam fighters in order to find Israeli captives. That same mechanism could be used to bring the fighters in Rafah back across the line. There was some talk that that would happen with the handover of Hadar Golden, who is an Israeli soldier who was captured in the 2014 war. The negotiations for that, again, Hamas fulfilled, Qassam fulfilled its end of the negotiations and handed over that soldier from 2014, and still no deal on the captives. There's currently right now two brigades, the Nahal Brigade and the Golani Brigade, that are in that area of eastern Rafah looking for the fighters. And the IDF has said over the past 40 days, troops from the Nahal and Golani Brigades together with Yahalom Tunnel, the Yahalom are tunnel troops. The Yahalom troops under the command of the Gaza Division have been operating in a concentrated effort in eastern Rafah with the aim of dismantling the underground tunnel routes that remain in the area and the elimination of the fighters that are within them. In the past week, more than 40 fighters were eliminated in the areas of the tunnel control. And Israel just shows blurry drone video of them shooting at barely perceptible humans. So we don't have a solid understanding of who is being killed and if they're the fighters in question here. The Rafah crossing that is supposed to open in both directions at the end of phase one of the deal, which is very close to happening. And that area in eastern Rafah is where we are talking about. After a month of being attacked in ceasefire violations, fighters attacked the Israeli force that had come to the building that they were hiding out in, the tunnel had access to. The Israeli Defense Forces allowed publication of this matter, although they didn't show drone footage, which they have, that five of their soldiers were wounded, one seriously by Yassin 105 fire and a guerrilla action device that was affixed to the Namur troop carrier. The IDF report talks about the fighters exiting from the ruins, end quote. They're defending themselves against this raid. And the Israelis say subsequently a third militant who was not identified by our forces managed to approach and attach a guerrilla action device to the Namur. The IDF was searching the building where the two attackers emerged from a nearby underground cave. And we've seen that the fighters are in tunnels. They're also in caves, effectively, inside the demolished buildings that Rafah is. So a pretty significant operation that happened in Rafah yesterday. And all of this points to something that we have covered for the whole two-year war on the Resistance Report here. And that is that the fighters fight in territorial battalions. They don't leave their fighting positions and run to other fighting positions. They're not running all over Gaza harassing Israeli soldiers. They fight in their positions, which we've heard a number of times on video, one particularly from Sudanese poet Mohammed Abdel Bari, where he talks about the Battle of Uhud. And he says, "We will remain on the mountain of archers and behind us the voice of the prophet shaking us, do not leave, do not leave." This poem refers to the Battle of Uhud in the Quran, where the archers left their positions and it cost the Muslims the battle. So these fighters are literally staying on their Mount Uhud to carry out this battle. And when the lines were randomly cut there for the yellow line, they ended up on the other side of that line. And we've seen this territorial defense all over Gaza. It's why when the IDF invaded Zaytun 6, 7, 8 times, there was fighters there to meet them every time. Or in Deir al-Bala, where there was no invasion until the last days of the war, still, the first moment the Israelis moved in, they're hit by those territorial units. So we know these fighters are in Rafah holding their positions. What Rafah looks like, it's a very difficult environment to be a resistance fighter in. All of the buildings are destroyed. It's a shoot-to-kill zone. It's been a free-fire zone since the summer of 2024, so a year and a half now. But these fighters are still operating in Rafah. And this is the Rafah model, the moonscape that used to be the society of Rafah that has been completely erased. Like the mayor, Dr. Ahmed Al-Sufi, stated that everywhere in Rafah has been completely annihilated, calling it a disaster area, completely destroyed more than 90% of the homes in the Rafah governorate, which amounts to over 20,000 buildings containing 50,000 housing units. They destroyed all the wells. They destroyed the power plant, the water filtration plants. All of this is what is called the Rafah model. And Israel has been using this model with the attempt to create another state. There was a Wall Street Journal article in late November talking about how the U.S. wanted to create a green zone in Rafah where it would be separate from the resistance, separate from the Palestinian governance that would be created in the eastern area of Rafah, which is a silent, implicit understanding that Hamas is not going anywhere, that disarmament is not happening. But the idea of building on the eastern side is opposed by the Israeli cabinet, who doesn't want rebuilding to happen that close to the border again. Everybody knows that Rafah has been destroyed. Even the most pro-Israel newspapers admit that and show that. And in Israel, it's bragged about, because what Israel has been doing in this area is setting up military positions. More than 40 military bases have been set up across Gaza on the eastern side of the yellow line. Half of those are in southern Khan Yunis and Rafah area. So they have two brigades dedicated to finding these fighters. They have 13 sites in Rafah and another 11 in Khan Yunis. And they can't find these dozens of fighters that are still in Rafah. And we'll remember the Rafah Brigade. We were told the Rafah Brigade was defeated. The IDF said they were defeated in the summer of 2024. A few months later, we saw footage of Yahya Sinwar on the front lines commanding operations in Tel el-Sultan with the Tel el-Sultan battalion commander Mahmoud Hamdan, clearly showing that the Rafah Brigade had not been defeated. After that, we saw a whole series of actions from the Rafah Brigade called Operation Avenging Sinwar after Sinwar was killed in October of that year. Immediately, the Rafah Brigade came up with a whole series of operations. Same when the ceasefire was breached by Israel in March. In April, immediately, the Rafah Brigade carried out operations. And the IDF visited at that time, even though they had said they had defeated the Rafah Brigade on two other occasions. Chief of Staff Eyal Zamir returned to the Gaza Strip and told Israeli soldiers in Gaza that you return to fight in the Gaza Strip, I expect you to defeat the Rafah Brigade and lead to victory where you are fighting. They obviously did not defeat the Rafah Brigade at that time either. Israelis are actually using this territory right now in the ceasefire to do what they could not do during the war, which was try to find tunnel routes, auger machines, searching for tunnels by literally poking holes in the ground to find tunnel routes that they had been bragging about during the war that they had demolished. But we know now, watching this, that there's no way this kind of contraption could have been set up in contested territory where the resistance was fighting. Zamir said that the other day that there is no chief of staff deal concerning the trapped fighters. What he did say to the Israeli security cabinet last Thursday, he said, it's either surrender or we eliminate them. If they surrender, we'll take them in their underwear to Sidi Tamim for interrogation. So veiled rape threats there at Israel's torture prison. But the fighters aren't going to surrender to the Israelis. Anyone who's been following this war knows that that's the case. But let's look at the context of this. The Army radio report said that Israel is facing a significant test these days and is required to reshape the security reality in the Gaza Strip, the policy, and also set precedents. The enemy must be assessed not only to be the final results of its actions, even a shooting incident without casualties must be responded to as if a soldier was killed. In other words, massacre the civilian population like we saw in the tent massacres that followed the resistance operation in Rafah, the burning of tents in Khan Yunis. Army radio says the American command is definitely involved. The IDF gave advance notice of the intention to strike, but did not wait for a green light or approval for the attack, nor did it update on the targets of the strike or who they intended to eliminate. Here, again, every event sets a precedent for the future and shapes the reality ahead. So from the Israeli point of view, they're not really telling the command center what their operations are. They're just letting the operation center watch, and the operation center seems to have no problem with that. Drone footage is being monitored 24/7 in this facility in southern Israel. This is described as a warehouse in southern Israel. It's not on a military base, but a number of Israeli military commentators bristle at this idea that the Americans are set up within their territory as an act against their sovereignty, and they worry what it's going to look like when another president that's not Trump is in charge of this situation. So just to let people have a good understanding of what the Americans are seeing on the ground about this situation, Qassam has responded to this. They put out this poster the other day that said, "Surrender is not in our dictionary. In vain they try to uproot us. We will sprout from blood. We are the roots and our branches reach to the sky." It says the fighters are not going to surrender. The Qassam Brigades issued a statement that said the enemy should know that in our lexicon or in our dictionary, surrendering or handing oneself over to the occupier has no meaning. This is from a larger statement by Qassam. This is the only fulsome statement that they have delivered about this. Is from early November. They say the occupation bears full responsibility for the clashes with our fighters in Rafah who are defending themselves inside an area under its control. The enemy must know that the principle of surrender and handing over oneself to the enemy does not exist in the lexicon of the Al-Qassam Brigades. We place before the mediators their responsibilities, and they must find a solution to ensure the continuation of the ceasefire to prevent the enemy from using flimsy pretexts to violate it and to exploit that to target the innocent civilians of Gaza, which is what Israel is doing. It's what they did yesterday after the attack on their soldiers. They carried out massacres in tent camps in Khan Yunis. And the spokesperson for Hamas, Hazem Qassam, who's in Gaza, said, "Those fortified in Rafah are marks of glory and signs of pride for everyone who belongs to this nation." The second to last handover of Israeli captives is happening right now. Saraya al-Quds and Qassam and the ICRC, the International Committee of the Red Cross, doing the handover. There is now only one remaining captive's body in Gaza. Saraya al-Quds held these bodies, not Qassam, which is something that we knew all along, that other groups were holding many of these bodies, particularly of the non-soldiers. And the statement said from Saraya al-Quds and the Qassam Brigades yesterday that within the framework of the Al-Aqsa-Fraud prisoner exchange, Saraya al-Quds and the martyr Izzedine al-Qassam Brigades will hand over the body of one of the occupation's prisoners, which has been found in the north of the Gaza Strip today at 5 p.m. That is the 27th of 28 to be handed over. So the difficult task of finding all of the Israeli captives is virtually complete. The 20 living soldiers were handed back, and most of these 28 have been soldiers or security forces. So that is the resistance report for day 790 of Israel's genocidal war in Gaza.
That was the Electronic Intifada's John Elmer. You're listening to Electronic Intifada Radio with me, Nora Barrows-Friedman. On November 17th, the United Nations Security Council adopted UN Resolution 2803 to establish a Board of Peace as a so-called transitional authority to oversee Gaza's reconstruction and the deployment of an international stabilization force. The Electronic Intifada's executive director, Ali Abu Nima, reports on the latest in the Trump administration's plan to occupy Gaza with a foreign force working on behalf of Israel, a plan that appears to be falling apart before it even gets off the ground.
We talked with international human rights lawyer and former UN official Craig Mukhaibar about the outrageous Security Council resolution passed last month that gave the UN's blessing to Trump's so-called peace plan for Gaza. There is no peace in Gaza. There's no ceasefire. And you'll remember what Craig Mukhaibar said, quote, "This resolution is a real direct assault on the Palestinian people, on their rights, on their hopes of liberation. It is an atrocity with the UN insignia on it." And Mukhaibar really said that it imp-